You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hey there, Glenn. How's it going?
Not too bad, Dad. How are you?
I'm doing well. This is Glenn Lowry, professor at Brown University. You, if you're viewing this video, are watching The Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv. The Glenn Show is sponsored by the Watson Institute for Public and International Affairs, where I'm affiliated at Brown University. And I am here talking with my son, Glenn Lowry II. You may notice a family resemblance. Now, we are talking in part in response to popular demand, Glenn, because the last time we talked, which I believe was back in January, some of the comments said, oh, they loved it. They think you're great. They think I'm okay. And they think we should do more of these kind of conversations. And so I just thought, here we are now, early September, and it might be time for us to do another conversation. So
Yes.
Glad that you're coming on, my son, Glenn Lowry II.
Who on the Squared Show today?
How would you introduce yourself, your titles and positions and all of that?
I would call myself Glenn. Glenn Lowry II, aspiring writer and current banker, sitting at home in the bedroom actually because Rob is out cleaning stuff and doing things, so he asked me to record in here.
Your partner Rob out, so you are home alone. McCoy is.
Well, no, he's here. He's just out in the living room.
Okay,
doing dishes.
Okay,
but I'm here. I'm in here with McCoy. I'm doing good.
I'm glad to hear it. You are in Weymouth, Massachusetts. I am in Toulouse, France. So we're doing a transatlantic father-son chat. That's pretty exciting.
The wonders of technology.
I have a question to ask you. We had agreed in advance not to talk about politics because, believe it or not, Blogging Heads audience, that is not always the most pleasant conversation between my son and myself.
I'd say it's rarely the most pleasant conversation.
We have different political orientations, but I want to ask you, you describe yourself as a banker, and I'm just curious whether that gives you any dissonance being a man of the left. I think that's an apt description of you. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Even people of the left have to, you know, buy groceries and do things. I think it's not fair that just because you do not believe that society is oriented in the right way that you expect people not to participate in it. I think that's a silly expectation that a lot of people have. You know, you see people, I can't remember who it was on Fox News, like, oh, you're a socialist, then why don't you teach for free? Oh, well, that's stupid.
yeah,
that's not how that works.
And I think even the late, great Karl Marx would have to testify to that. A guy's got to eat. He's got to feed his kids if he has any.
Yeah, I believe the saying, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs, still has things going to people according to their needs, not from each according to their ability, and then to you, you starve in the street.
All right. You add to your intro, however, that you are an aspiring writer, and that's one of the things that I was really interested in talking with you about, because I would like it if you would tell people a bit about your art, since I have been appreciating it for some time, and where they can find it and what you're up to. My son Glenn is a writer, and I don't use that term casually. I think you are a writer. I think you have talent, and I think people should know about you. Why don't you talk a little bit about your work?
Okay, sure. So I've been writing for, I guess, the past 3 years now online. It started on Twitter, where I would be writing just little, you know, I think they would call it micro fiction, where you'd be telling stories 140, now 280 characters at a time, and then I started writing short fiction, longer fiction, but still short fiction on a website that I started called beyondthepale.us. And I was doing that for a couple of years, collected a couple of collections of stuff that I had written, and then using the wonderful powers of the internet and the capitalist tool called Amazon, I published some of my fiction online. And then in January, I started a Patreon, you know, because you gotta make money to eat, patreon.com/Glenn Lowry, where I've been posting a chapter at a time, a few of the novels that I've been working on. And I've been doing that for the past 9 months. And then in June, was this June? I think it was either the end of June, start of July, around there, I published my first novella, so a longer completed work called Invisible Funerals, which was based on Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities. So if you're familiar with that, it's about Kublai Khan and Marco Polo, and Marco Polo is telling Kublai Khan about all these fantastic cities that he's seen, which may or may not have actually existed throughout the Khan's massive kingdom. And so I took that conceit and adapted it to a speculative fiction kind of framework, where a man is telling his captors about the burial practices that he's seen on his travels throughout the galaxy. And they sort of get, it builds on itself in a way that people seem to like. So,
well, I want to say, and this is not just fatherly pride, though it is fatherly pride to some degree, I want to say that these works of yours, Love Letters and Elegies, that was your earlier collection, Invisible Funerals, they're available at Amazon.com. If you go there and look for the books, look for the books of Glenn Lowry, you will find my books, and you should skip right past them, and you'll also find Glenn Lowry II's books, which you should pay some attention to.
But I promise you, they're interesting than your books.
I'm sorry, say it again?
I was promising the audience that they're much more interesting than your books, and they're probably easier to read.
Okay, I'm just going to let that go. I'm a social scientist, so my books are full of all kinds of logic chopping, turgid, statistics laden, politically sensitive argument. And my son's books are flights of fantasy and imagination that are artfully rendered craft being exhibited at every sentence and so on and so forth. But I have to ask you this question, Love Letters and Elegies. Invisible Funerals. Somehow, death seems to be a ever-present element in your writing. Am I correct in saying that? And if so, can you explain where you think that comes from?
Death is all around us. And I think it probably is because of my experiences with death, in particular our joint experience of losing Linda Datcher Lowry, my mom, and your second wife, your intellectual partner of 35 years or so.
37 to be precise.
37 years, almost 30 of those spent in holy matrimony. And, you know, that happened at a very formative time for me. I was struggling at school, and that compounded those struggles. And I sort of spent a few years after that adrift, not really sure what I wanted to do with myself, not really succeeding at anything and not really having any drive or direction, until I stumbled into the profession that I'm in currently, banking, which gave me a little structure. And then within that structure, I was allowed the freedom to find what I actually enjoy doing, which is writing. And then, you know, they say, write what you know. So I guess the stories that always occurred to me sort of had a similar sort of theme. So love letters and elegies. I wrote in the intro to that something along the lines of that love and death are two sides of the same coin. And so those are sort of the themes. Because, you know, you say I write a lot about death, and that's true. But I think I also write an equal amount about love, and not just romantic love, but, you know, love for yourself, which is something that I've struggled with. Love for life, for what you're doing, for the world around you, which I think is necessary, because otherwise it's just death. Otherwise we're just walking down this path that ends and there's no point to it.
Yeah, I should tell people that we lost your mother, my late wife, Dr. Linda Datcher-Lowry, who succumbed after a long struggle to breast cancer at the age of 59 in 2011. There's a wonderful obituary describing her work and her life that was published in the Boston Globe in September of 2011. Anyone can find it. And it, yes, has been a traumatic and profound event in your life, in my life, of course it would be. I feel compelled to mention here, I'm not sure exactly why, that my father, Everett Lowry, age 88, he'll be 89 in September 30th, should he live that long, but there's every chance that he will not. He's in hospice care now and is no longer eating food or drinking liquids, and his kidney function is pretty much nil, and it looks like he's in the last days of his life. And so with profound regret, we anticipate his imminent demise. Not the sort of thing one usually gets at bloggingheads.tv, I suppose. Not the sort of thing people usually talk about in public, but then we're the Glens. We're the Glen Squared edition here, and we wear our feelings on our sleeve to a certain degree, and we're not afraid to face up to the joys and to the sorrows of life and share them with each other, and in this particular forum with whomever might tune in.
Well, I mean, it's something that happens to everyone. And I think people, it's interesting for something that happens so often that people are never really comfortable discussing it and certainly not talking about it honestly. You know, there sort of is this tendency after someone dies in the eulogy to make a myth of that person and not to really talk honestly about who they were to you and who you were to them. People into mountains when maybe it was a little more complicated than that. So, you know, I don't know how honest do you want to get here, but...
Well, let's just take the gloves off and go for honesty. I think that's probably the best policy. That's where the great art is going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah, because what we're not talking about here with your father is how you're in France and I'm here, and there are reasons for that.
That is to say, we're not at his bedside.
No, and perhaps would not be welcome, and there are reasons for that. And perhaps we wouldn't want to go, and there are reasons for that.
That's all very true, and the degree of honesty becomes excruciatingly painful at this point.
Yeah. Well, that's why I asked.
Yeah, well, let's save some of the linen. I'm not going to call it dirty linen. Let's leave some of the most powerful moments for our writing. Maybe we don't want to just spout off, but yeah, there are reasons for that. Yeah, the estrangements and the distance across the generations and so on. But I'll say this, I'll say that I don't think I would be the man that I am today if it weren't for the influence of my father, Everett Lowry, and that I love him and mourn his imminent demise, though I have had occasion to wish that the nature of our relationship and certainly the nature of his relationship with you were different than it has proven to be.
So do I. But I mean, I guess if he was responsible for shaping you, he's indirectly responsible for shaping me into the person that I am as well.
I'll tell you this story. I don't know if I've ever told you this story about my dad. So I was a college dropout. My girlfriend, the mother of Lisa and Tamara, became pregnant when she was 15 years old and gave birth at the age of 16. I was 18 when she gave birth to my oldest child, Lisa, your sister. And my dad took me aside and he said, son, you're ruining your life. You really need to shape up. I had been a very bright kid in high school, graduated at the age of 16, got a scholarship to attend the Illinois Institute of Technology, and promptly began cutting classes and playing pool and riding around in convertibles, trying to have fun with my friends who were also not interested in going to class and so forth. And so I was like a wreck, and my dad was disgusted with the course that my life was taking. He thought that I was squandering my talents, and he basically turned his back on me. Not completely, didn't stop talking to me, but his contempt was not thinly veiled. And I wanted to show him that I was worth a damn, and determined that I was going to make something of myself, in part so as not to be subject to the withering contempt that he was capable of expressing without reservation. I cared about his opinion about me. I wanted to earn my place in his good graces. And I doubled down and, you know, I got a full-time job. I married my girlfriend, who was the mother of now two children, Lisa and Tamara. I went to school at night and then full-time during the day while working at night, et cetera, not to make this a self-congratulatory soliloquy, but just to say that I got my life back on track. I ended up at the age of 27 with a PhD in economics from MIT, and that's where I met your mother, my second wife. Unfortunately, my marriage to Charlene didn't work out. You know, I got myself on a different track, and that's why I say I think that without the influence of my father, as much as it chafed at the time, I don't know that things would have come out quite the way that they would have, that they have done. I don't know. You might have a similar story or something. I'm not asking you to tell it if you're not so moved, but fathers do have that kind of impact on their sons, don't they?
They tend to, yeah. I was trying to think if I did.
This is the honest edition of Bloggerheads.tv, people.
I mean, I don't think we have the same relationship that you and your father had for a number of different reasons. I remember telling you very confidently to watch what I do. This after a string of failures.
All right, we're back after a disruption of our connection, and my son Glenn Lowry was in mid-sentence. He was speaking about his college career. Please continue, my son.
Okay, trying to pick up the thread. I was talking about a memory I had. I flunked out of two colleges, Haverford, UMass. I had gotten a job that didn't really have any real career prospects or any destination at Cheers. And then I had lost that job. And I called you to tell you that I had lost that job. And I was very afraid of your, what your reaction might be. because our relationship was very contentious, I would say, between the ages, my ages of 16 and 23, 24. It was a pretty rough patch for us.
You're 29 years old right now.
Yeah, I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm just explaining to the listeners.
29, yeah. So five, you know, up until about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I called you to tell you what had happened. And I can't remember exactly what you said, but I remember your reaction was, okay, so what happens next? What are you going to do now? And I think up until that point, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, if you remember this interaction, up until that point, you had a very definite idea of who you wanted me to be, the footsteps you wanted me to follow. You had this vision of me following in your footsteps as an academic, as having a successful collegiate career. And this was the moment, or this was one of the moments, because I don't think in life there are like one pivotal moment where everything changes. It's sort of like these gradual increments, where you either realize something about somebody or your relationship changes. And this was one of those steps, I think, that you took along the road of letting me go. You know, cause you can only raise a child so far. After a certain point, you know, they're going to sink or swim on their own. And in this moment, you said something along the lines of, well, if you need something, let me know, but what are you going to do? Which is something that I had to figure out for myself, which was liberating. It was liberating.
Yeah, I don't disagree with your recollection about how things went. Certainly the rough patch was a rough patch. Man, it was a rough patch. I don't know that I wanted you to be an academic, that is to say a professor of something who does research. But yeah, I did envision you being at the top of your graduating class from Haverford College. You told me you were interested in Islam, and I said, oh, he's going to learn Arabic. My son's going to be an Arabic speaker. You know what? I'm going around telling people, yeah, my son's going to be an Arabic speaker and so forth, thinking that you would immerse yourself in the arduous task of mastering the Arabic language, et cetera, et cetera. You had some rather different ideas about what you wanted to do with your life, or rather hadn't yet figured out what you wanted to do, but knew that that was not what you wanted to do. So yeah, man, you know, 60 grand a year is the freight at Haverford College, at least it was back then with the room and board. That ain't chicken feed, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The temptation to say, you know, I'm going broke trying to get you an education. Why can't you? Whatever is a very, very powerful temptation. But to any parent who may be listening out there, that is not a recommended course of action if you're trying to actually love, support, and understand your child. Berating them about how they're wasting your money because they're not doing at college what you would have done had you been in their place. And yeah, acceptance. I mean, I learned this, we're talking Turkey here, I learned this in my years trying to recover from cocaine addiction way back 30 years ago, that acceptance is a huge part of being able to live well with adversity. I mean, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's kind of a nostrum, the serenity prayer, but there's a whole lot of truth in it. And I accepted that you were your own person, and yeah, I'm here. I support you. I love you, but you've got to figure out your own path. It's not going to be my path. And let's see what happens. And I must say, I, 5 years down that road, am very happy with what has happened. So we were talking about how you speak about the dead, or how it tends that people want not to speak honestly about those who have expired because death brings out not always the best in us. And I was struck by some of the commentary I saw from you at social media about Senator John McCain, who passed away not long ago and whose life has been celebrated on a national stage. I know we're not supposed to talk about politics, and I promise not to try to counter anything that you say with a political retort, but given that you're the author of Love Letters and Elegies, and you're the author of Invisible Funerals, and we are within just a week of the great funeral of the great man, do you want to share with the Blog Hits audience any of your reactions to the way in which his life had been celebrated by, you know, the country?
A little, I guess. so I get, I mean, John McCain dies, and John McCain has this reputation of being a quote-unquote maverick who quote-unquote stood up to his party and quote-unquote was a member of the resistance against Donald Trump. And I don't really think the facts bore out how far people took that. And I think in part that was because John McCain, who was perhaps most talented at crafting his own image, and because we have this tendency, I think people in politics report on it like it's a game, like people's positions don't really matter as long as they are playing the game the right way. So you sort of see this now with, you know, a lot of people have the tendency of saying, oh, Donald Trump's president and he's so brash and boorish and rude and openly racist, misogynistic, what have you. He has this unsavory past, this unsavory relationship with women, these accusations that have been made against him every day. He flaunts the Constitution in some bold and flagrant way, you know, enriching it, using the presidency to enrich himself and what have you. And they look at that man and they say, oh, doesn't that make you miss George W. Bush? Because he was grandfatherly and nice and he was somebody you'd want to have a beer with. And when people say that, I'm like, one bad president does not make another bad president good. You know, when a group of war criminals, and again, I don't really want to talk about politics.
Okay, but we're talking about McCain.
Yeah, we're talking about McCain. So George Bush was at his funeral. Henry Kissinger was at his funeral.
Yeah,
speaking at his funeral. And people were tweeting things like, his funeral was the greatest resistance meeting that's ever happened or what have you. And I'm like, well, what are we talking about? What is a resistance if the architects of our current age are members of that resistance? What are we talking about here? What's being resisted when somebody who caused 500,000 deaths based on a lie and someone else who was an architect of some of Richard Nixon's greatest atrocities are members of that? Like, so I think we have this tendency to look at America dishonestly. We want to believe that there's this tendency towards American exceptionalism that I don't think is earned. And we want the faces of that American exceptionalism to be worshipped, because in order to honestly look at that, we'd have to honestly look at the country itself and what it's done. And that's all I really wanted to say. That's what I've been saying on social media. Just sort of, I don't want to take anything away because I know what it's like to lose a parent from how Meghan McCain is grieving, because that's not what this is about. Everybody should be allowed to grieve and to bury their father or their mother or their husband or their wife. But the whole country doesn't have to grieve along with them, especially if some of those people are people who have been harmed by his policies or by the fact that he
confirm Donald Trump's whole cabinet, or that he basically opened the door for Donald Trump by nominating a woefully unqualified woman to be his vice presidential candidate. You have to look at how people are responsible for the way the world is.
Okay, well, I'll say this much. I mean, I don't disagree with anything that you said, and I don't want to have a political discussion because we don't want to have a political discussion. Mm-hmm.
Too late for that, I guess, but no more political discussion.
But, you know, funerals are about the living, not about the dead, really, and it struck me, and I don't know if you, the author of Invisible Funerals, would share that view, although your book suggests as much. It was an occasion, the death of John McCain and the obligatory celebration of his life, to make points about contemporary politics that had something, but not everything, to do with John McCain. It had a lot to do with the partisan back and forth that we're experiencing now, and the perception that Donald Trump, who was a nemesis or antithesis or something, I'm not sure what the right word is here, certainly an enemy of John McCain, people's dislike of Donald Trump left them perhaps unable to resist the temptation to use McCain's death as an occasion to score some points against the president. So that was somewhat unseemly. War criminals, we could get into an argument, but then we'd be arguing about politics.
Yes, does not interest me.
We're not going to do that.
I'm sure your viewers will rebuke me appropriately in the comments, like they.
Oh, you noticed that, huh? Yeah. Well, some of my people,
the great unwashed liberals, who's walking into this ivory tower podcast.
Well, no. Did you see the one where the guy said, "You're an economist, Glenn." He's speaking of me. Mm-hmm. Didn't you even talk any economics around the dinner table to yourself? How can you come up being such a know-nothing lefty with such ridiculous economic ideas? And he's the son of an economist. And I'm sure you are the son of two economists. Mm-hmm. And plenty of economics was discussed around the dinner table. Some of it took and some of it didn't, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, I would say that if I just was repeating everything that you said back to me, you probably weren't doing your job correctly.
Yeah, that's probably right. And believe me, there are many economists who share your views about corporate greed or about the Republican Party or about capitalism. Though I want to reiterate that I think markets and incentives and private property and all of that are essential institutions, foundation for our prosperity and so forth and so on. But that's for another blogging, yes, I suppose.
And also I would say that we haven't really talked about what my views are. I don't really want to get into whether I believe in private property, but I don't think your viewers know what I think either, because we haven't talked about it publicly.
You don't think my viewers know
what my views are on private property? Because about like wealth. I think that's all we got into, like what the absolute good of wealth is. Discussion.
They stereotype you as some, social justice warrior, lefty, socialistic type and whatnot. And no, you did not have an opportunity to exposit your full view if you've got a well-developed view. But I want to go back now.
I'd like to go back to talk about funerals, death.
Okay.
Who, what that's for, because it reminded me of another story. So my mom's funeral, and the controversy surrounding that, or what happened.
What controversy?
So you and Lisa.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That controversy.
I remember one of the things that I said back then was that this is not for you. And I said that to both of you. This is the last time that we're going to be able to say goodbye to Mom.
Can I explain to the viewer that at the funeral of your mother, my wife, my firstborn, my daughter Lisa, and I had a bitter argument that came close to disrupting the harmony that should attend such a august occasion, and that you intervened, telling everybody to keep their powder dry and keep, stay focused on what was important.
Yeah. Yeah. Because a funeral is the last time that we really talk about that person. I mean, yeah, we remember them. There are stories, but it's the last time that we really have an event that's dedicated to them. So I, you know, I don't agree that a funeral is wholly for the living. Obviously, it's partly for us to say goodbye, to remember that person. And I think we owe it to them to remember them at the last events that's ever going to be wholly for them, that we remember them honestly. So there's this book written by a man I don't really care for, Orson Scott Card, called Speaker of the Dead. I could get into why I don't really like Orson Scott Card, but that's not what this is about. He was an author of, maybe you've heard of it, Ender's Game.
I've heard of it, yeah.
So this is the sequel to that book. And just to explain it briefly, Ender's Game is about a child who helps humanity defend itself against an alien invasion, who then discovers that everything wasn't as it seemed, regarding the invasion, and that he was in part responsible for a mass act of genocide. And he's trying to find a way to redeem himself for that. And in doing so, he sort of carries the religious tradition of this alien people to the human race. And the way that they remembered themselves was with whole honesty. So when people are being buried, you went through the whole parts of their lives, everything that they did that was good, and everything that they did that was bad. And the people who would speak at these events were called speakers for the dead. They'd go over the person's lives like a fine tooth comb and try to come up with a quote unquote fair and balanced view of who that person was. And that was a book that I read when I was a kid. And I think it had a really huge influence on me and how I think that death should be viewed. Because I think if somebody dies and then in their eulogy, we remember who we wish they were and not who they actually are, or as close as we can get to who they actually are, because you only ever see the person how you see them. So that's through your eyes, yeah, through your lens of interpretation. That person doesn't actually exist. So when somebody dies, you lose who they actually are, who they are inside, that person that you never really knew. But you can get as close as you can as possible to remembering that person by being honest after they die with how you saw them.
And a community of people, each of whom is honest with the others about how they saw this person, can perhaps arrive at a clearer vision, each one of them, for who this person actually was.
You can get close. And I think we don't really do that in this country. Or any other country I'm not too familiar with, other burial practices. But one of the things that I was trying to touch on in Invisible Funerals was how people are remembered, and what purpose that serves for the person who's dead and what purpose that serves for the community. So, for example, one of the things I took, one of the stories that I tell, because the way that it works is that he sort of tells these cycles of stories, involves people on Pluto. And
there's a limited amount of resources. So there's a lottery that's run for everyone over a certain age. And those people who are chosen are then cast out into space. And their lives, their death, serves a utility. It serves a purpose to keep the rest of the people alive. And I think the way that death is used in this book, it has utility. I think telling stories of who people are helps people grieve more easily. Because I think if somebody dies, and if you lionize them, and they didn't deserve to be lionized, then you have all these unresolved feelings and nowhere to go with them, because you know, you go to this funeral and everybody's talking about how this person was a great man or woman, and all the things they did. And inside, you have these unresolved issues. And where are you supposed to go with that if at this last moment that person isn't eulogized honestly?
Yeah, I hear you. This is pretty heavy.
Well, that's the stuff I write.
People should check you out because the craft is also noteworthy. It's filled with beautiful turns of phrase and elegant, exquisitely rendered scenes and personalities. I can still remember the impact of Love Letters and Elegies, your opening vignette and your closing vignette in that collection of the old man in the bar and you're going to get up.
Yeah, the frame story. Yeah,
the frame story. That's what you writers call it. Yeah.
That's what I mean. That's literally what I call that story because it's the end of the book and the beginning of the book. It's the device. Yeah.
Very nicely done. I hope people will check you out, those who are interested in science fiction or just in literature, because you've got something to offer. And in view of the fact that you have something to offer, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what it's like day to day, having to get up at 6 a.m. or whatever time to make your way to your banker's job and find time to write, having your love, your heart be vested in the activity that doesn't actually butter your bread, at least not nearly as much as you need to eat, and aspiring, you know, for a breakthrough to be discovered, not to put words in your mouth, but the sense of this is you treading water. I mean, what is it like to have to manage the mundane and the pragmatic so on over and against the thing that really inhabits your spirit and makes you want to soar? Do you feel compromised, confined, constrained? Again, not to put words in your mouth. I'm just curious how you see it, how you process it.
So I think I'm lucky in part because I like what I do on a day-to-day basis. I like my job. I enjoy doing what I do, and that makes it easier. Because I feel like I don't have to push myself to escape. You know, because there are all these cliches about writing, and people say, write every day. You know, whatever you do, just make sure that you're getting something down on the page every day. And I honestly don't think, oh, Cammy just called me. I don't think that that's necessarily healthy. So the way that I do it is I sort of take it as it comes. So the most recent book, Invisible Funerals, I wrote the first draft of that book on Twitter entirely in the space of like 4 days. I had been talking to somebody and somebody had just written something and I responded back to them like, what if there was Italo Calvino's book, but for burials? And I was like, well, that's a great idea. And that's also just sort of tumbled out. So I'd sort of take it from a number of different ways. So with my Patreon, there are people who are paid and give me suggestions. And one of those suggestions, well, it'll spawn a short story, but then maybe that'll blossom into something else. And then I have like 100 different things that I'm usually working on at once. So I don't have like an incredibly focused approach to it. And the thing, my job allows me to not have to worry about producing things on a schedule. I know that I have these ideas, and I work on them when I can, but I don't worry about those ideas making or breaking my living. And I think that's a privilege, because a lot of people who are professional authors are, you know, that's their bread and butter. If they don't come up with a book by a certain deadline, then they're screwed. But it allows me to take my time and, you know, come up with the product that I want to write the way that I want to write it. So I'm not beholden to editors. I'm not beholden to publishers. You know, people are going to say, because I talk to writers all the time on social media, who talk about all the setbacks that they get from the publishing world, especially speculative fiction writers of color, especially female speculative fiction writers of color. Mm. So they'll get a pushback where their story is too black or their story is too queer. So one of the things that I take pride of in my writing is that I'm always centering a queer experience. My main characters are pretty much always, you know, and like people would say, well, that's not reflective of real life. I'm like, well, I'm not trying to reflect real life. I'm trying to reflect myself. And I think before I started writing, I felt a lot of anxiety, and I couldn't really localize why. And it's because there was all this stuff, all these words inside me that needed to get out. And so I use it as an outlet. And then I realized that that outlet could actually be something. And so sometimes I worry, they call it imposter syndrome, that because of the way I write, that I'm not really a real author, that what I do isn't real, and that nobody is paying attention. And so this, one of the things...
I'm sorry, this is your thought? Or this is someone...
This is my thought. My thought. You know, cause it's easy when it's something that you're doing not as a profession, but in your spare time when you can, to look at it and think, this is, you know, you're never going to make it. And not even knowing what making it looks like. And I think writing Invisible Funerals really helped me with that, because I got a lot of positive feedback, and it's the first thing that I read of mine, something that I read and I looked at it and was like, well, this is really something. This is actually good.
Wow. That had to feel pretty good.
But, you know, after years is, yeah, it's a good feeling. I've sort of drifted away from your original question, but I guess that was the point. So I guess the way that I do it is, you know, I get up at 5 every day, because McCoy gets up at 5 and I feed McCoy. And if I have 30 minutes, I'll write for 30 minutes. If I have an hour, I'll write for an hour. Sometimes I'll draft stuff on my phone so that if I have an idea, I won't forget it. And then it's sort of piecemeal. Things sort of come together slowly, and then all at once, and then slowly, and then all at once. And then every once in a while, I have something that I can put out there.
Who are your heroes in the world of literature? Who are your models? Who inspires you?
So my favorite authors are probably N.K. Jemisin, who wrote the Broken Earth trilogy, which was this a monumental work. She's actually, the first person ever to win, let me see, it was either the Hugo or the Nebula Award 3 years in a row. And there was a lot of controversy surrounding her. She was a woman of color, a black woman. Because there was all this pushback when the Hugo and Nebula Awards started nominating more people of color. There was this group that tried to like rig the voting against them because they were saying that white men were being pushed out of publishing. But she kept at it. And she's someone who's very vocal about her struggles on Twitter, which is something that I've appreciated because I think sometimes what you see, you just see the successes and you don't realize exactly how hard and how long people have been working to get to where they are. You just see the finished product. And that can be discouraging because it can make you think, oh, well, this just sort of came out fully formed, or this person just knew that they were going to be successful from day one, and that's not always how it happened. Another person I really enjoyed, I think we read one of his books for our book group, was Samuel Delaney. So he's been writing since the 60s, the 50s and 60s. Is one of the first gay black men to really be successful in the speculative fiction industry. And so he writes a lot about language, about how words can have an effect on people's very being. Idea I found interesting. And also is one of the first people to sort of write about identity as being a mutable thing, as being flexible, something that someone can self-determine. Which I think is something that we're just now getting to in our own society, is acknowledging is true, that people get to determine who they are for themselves.
Have you ever heard of Douglas Lane, L-A-I-N?
Well, that name rings a bell.
Now, he was nominated for a Hugo. I'm pretty sure he did not win. I mention him because I recorded a podcast with him for his podcast called Zero Books Podcast, and I put it up at the Glenn Show site at Blogging Heads. So should you be so moved, he is a science fiction, or I'm sorry, you say speculative fiction, don't you? He is a speculative fiction writer. He's also a Marxist, and I believe that his political outlook finds a way of expressing itself through the stories that he tells, although I have to confess I've not read any of his fiction. But I call him to your attention because I think you might find him to be interesting.
Mm.
So what do you see in the future for yourself as an artist, as a writer? What are your goals, if I don't misstep by asking such a protean, practical, bottom line question? How are you going to feed yourself when you're 40 years old, son?
No. Well, those are two different questions, aren't they? What are your goals and how are you going to feed yourself when you're 40 years old?
Yeah, I was being flippant.
Yeah, because a goal isn't necessarily like a financial metric for success. My goal is to write. I mean, I want to finish. I'm working on three longer books right now on my Patreon, and my goal is to finish one of them by the end of the year, which I think I can do. And then I'll see what happens from there. You know, I'll probably put it out myself, and I'll see if people are interested. And then my goal after that is to finish another book. And then my goal after that is to finish another book.
Okay. You're just going to keep writing and let the chips fall.
Just going to keep doing and see what happens. If I never get there, I'll never get there. I have a job.
Okay.
Sometimes people's dreams aren't achieved. And if that's what happens to me, then that's what happens to me. But as long as what I write is something that I'm proud of, then I have to tell myself that that's okay. But what, if you were to ask me what my dream ideal would be?
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant to ask.
Yeah. I would like to write full time. I would like to be able to sustain myself with that. But that is realistically very hard and happens to only a few people, and even people who are successful authors. So Nalo Hopkinson,
who is a brilliant writer, everybody should know.
So she wrote The Salt Roads, which she read. She was talking about how in between books, she would often have to take other jobs. Because this was in response to, did you hear about that guy, Jeffrey Owens, on the Cosby Show?
No.
Fox News found working. So Fox News posted something. He was exposed as working at a Trader Joe's. And I think they were trying to make fun of him or something. And a lot of people in the film industry, TV industry, and then a lot of writers were talking about, so you only see the most successful people, George Clooney, Stephen King, Bryan Cranston, the peak of the industry, TV, film, books, are really the only people who are sustaining themselves solely from doing that one thing. Most people, even the successful authors, even the authors whose names you know, have to do something else in addition to writing because it is so hard to make money from that. So I think just viewing that practically, I have to expect that that's something that I'm not going to be able to do, like in all likelihood.
Well,
and then
I was just going to say, if Nalo Hopkinson was having a hard time making it as a writer, this is a Afro-Canadian woman, resides in Toronto. Her book, The Salt Roads, is this monumental achievement. I don't even want to begin to describe it. That's something that you should do, but it's clearly the work of a very gifted writer. And she's having a hard time making it. That's got to be a sobering note to anybody who's trying to make it in that field.
Well, I mean, I guess that raises the question of what is making it. She's written some significant works. I would say that's making it. I would say if I write anything that is one-fourth as good or as meaningful as The Salt Roads, then I will have made it, even if the next day I have to get up and walk into a bank to earn a paycheck. Because I will have done something that mattered.
I think we should bring this conversation to a close. I'm sorry to have to report to you that a text just came in from my sister notifying me that my dad passed away earlier today, your grandfather.
Yeah,
and, did you receive the same notification?
That must be.
It would be.
Is that Tammy sent me?
It'd probably be Tammy, your sister.
Yep. Yeah.
So. I guess I'm going to need some time to think about that and sort through my feelings about that because it's not the place and the time to do it.
No.
But I do want to extend some condolences around to people whose lives are going to be adversely affected by my father's demise. Let them know I'm thinking about them and such. So let me get on to that.
Okay, I should probably call Tammy back.
Yeah. Okay, my son, thank you for coming on this mordant edition of The Glenn Show. Let's talk again soon and happier times.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, signing off now.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits of Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.